There are many more Radio 4 news and current affairs programmes to download for free. Find these on the website at bbc.co.uk/radio4.
Order, order.
Good evening. This is Susan Hume at Westminster. Tonight, 15 years after the opening of the Scottish Parliament, a blueprint to give sweeping new powers to Holyrood.
It is an historic moment for Scotland.
But nationalists say it's less than Scots were promised. Also tonight, the Transport Secretary insists it's right to sell off the East Coast Rail franchise. An MP says vital evidence on child abuse held by a hotel owner has gone missing.
She had all kinds of photographs of establishment figures at her hotel. And one of them allegedly showed a former cabinet minister in a sauna with a naked boy.
And a former Anglican bishop suggests this as a model for the coronation of the next head of the Church of England.
It was arranged that the Quran be read in the cathedral when everyone had been seated and welcomed, but before the actual Christian service began.
But first tonight, the Scottish Secretary Alistair Carmichael has said plans for further Scottish devolution can usher in home rule for the whole United Kingdom. He was speaking in the Commons following the unveiling of the findings of the Smith Commission, which was asked to flesh out the promises made for more Scottish devolution on the eve of the independence referendum. The Commission has recommended radical new powers for the Scottish Government, including control over income tax rates and bans and some welfare measures. 16 and 17-year-olds will be given a vote at Holyrood elections. Alistair Carmichael called it a historic moment.
This agreement provides a modern blueprint, Scottish home rule within our strong United Kingdom. Home rule for Scotland that can open the door to constitutional reform for the rest of the United Kingdom. We can achieve home rule all round.
Initially, Labour had been opposed to the idea of giving Holyrood power over income tax. They feared that would add weight to calls to stop Scottish MPs voting on the budget at Westminster. But the party has welcomed the Commission's findings. Control of other taxes, such as national insurance and corporation tax, will stay with the Treasury. The Shadow Scottish Secretary, Margaret Curran, called it a promise kept, a momentous agreement to deliver a powerhouse Parliament.
For the past 2 years, our country was divided along yes and no lines. Today marks an important moment. There are no longer yes and no's, just Scots with new powers. And we look forward to working across Scotland to deliver this.
The Smith Commission included the Scottish Nationalists, who agreed the final draft. The SNP deputy leader, Stuart Hosey, welcomed the report as far as it went.
I do welcome the report as modest progress. However, can I ask the Scottish Secretary to confirm that however it's dressed up, these proposals do not reflect the powerhouse Parliament which many in Scotland believe they've been promised before the referendum.
Comments which irritated a Labour MP, Sandra Osborne.
This is a very exciting day for Scotland, a day we should celebrate. And I was going to say to put the cynicism and division of the last few years behind us until I heard the member from Dundee.
The former Labour Chancellor, Alistair Darling, headed the No campaign and has argued against devolving fiscal powers, especially income tax, to Scotland. He welcomed the findings, but on a cautious note.
Will he ensure that we do nothing that undermines the integrity and the strength of the United Kingdom, and in particular that we do not undermine the fiscal union that is one of the central pillars of that United Kingdom? The majority of people in Scotland voted clearly to stay within the United Kingdom. I believe the majority of people in the entire United Kingdom want to see it continue, and we must be very careful that we manage this carefully.
A Conservative, Sir Tony Baldry, felt people in favour of low taxes should welcome the idea of different tax rates across the UK. It would encourage
a healthy competition between London and Edinburgh as to who sets the lowest rate of income tax. Because if Edinburgh starts to set a rate of income tax significantly higher than that set by this Parliament, then there is going to be a drift and movement of talent from Scotland down south. And likewise, if we set a rate of tax higher than in Edinburgh, people will start to move towards Scotland. So this competition should hopefully lead to lower rates of tax.
Scottish Labour MPs generally welcomed the findings, but there were plenty of English MPs who saw the downside. While Scots got more power over their own affairs, English voters did not, and Scottish MPs would still be allowed to vote at Westminster on purely English matters. David Cameron has said he wants to see English votes for English laws, but the latest devolution for Holyrood is not dependent on that. Here's the Conservative, Andrew Percy.
So apparently Home Rule for Scotland and the creation of a powerful Scottish Parliament can be determined and decided in the blink of an eye, but English votes for English laws needs to be kicked off into the long grass to a constitutional convention. Isn't the truth of these proposals that unless they go along with English votes for English laws, my constituents in Brigham and the people of England will continue to get the fluffy end of the lollipop?
And the Labour chair of the Constitutional Reform Committee, Graham Allen, has joined a score of local government leaders and spokesmen, including the Mayor of London, Boris Johnson, in a letter demanding similar devolution to English regions.
Can I welcome this and say this is a great day for democracy, and what's good enough for Scotland is now good enough for England.
But Plaid Cymru's Jonathan Edwards was angry that Wales had been offered far less power over tax.
And then only following another referendum many years down the line. When will Westminster stop treating Wales like a second-class nation?
And Labour's John Denham spoke up again for England.
Scotland's going to get what Scotland wants, but when is England going to get the chance to get what England wants?
Alistair Carmichael gave him the answer.
I am confident that England will get what England wants when England decides exactly what it is she does want.
And later, the Leader of the House, William Hague, who's chairing a Cabinet committee on the issue, said the government planned to publish its blueprint on the way forward for England before Christmas. You're listening to Today in Parliament on BBC Radio 4 with me, Susan Hume. Coming up, what's brought on this nostalgia for 1970s music?
ABBA's Dancing Queen.
Stand by your man.
Take a chance on me.
All to be revealed later. But first, the East Coast Mainline rail service is to be returned to private hands in a deal worth more than £3 billion to the government. It's awarded the franchise for the London to Edinburgh line to a consortium involving Virgin Trains. Labour claims the deal's been rushed through to stop it setting up a publicly owned company to bid for the contract if it wins the general election. Rebecca Keating reports.
It's the rail line where the Mallard set the world steam locomotive speed record and the stretch of track plied by the Flying Scotsman. Now, the East Coast Main Line is where
the taxpayer and the travelling public have been sold down the river. Yeah.
According to the Shadow Transport Secretary Michael Duggar, or
the government's franchising programme is creating the railways this country needs.
According to the Transport Secretary Patrick McLaughlin. He's announced that a consortium made up of Stagecoach and Virgin Trains will take over the East Coast Main Line, which is currently run by a publicly owned company. The firms have promised to invest £140 million over 8 years and will pay the government £3.3 billion for the contract.
These figures are robust. They have been subject to rigorous scrutiny, including independent auditors. So this deal will bring more services, more passengers and a growing return.
Intercity Railways, as it will be known, will add 23 new services from London and more than 3,000 extra seats in peak hour. But Dennis Skinner was just one of the Labour MPs who thought the return to private ownership went against the grain of public opinion.
On two occasions, the private sector have run this East Coast line and have been a failure. That whereas the public sector that have been running it for some considerable time have handed over more than £1 billion to the Treasury. Why change a winning formula?
Michael Duggar had an even stronger view on the ban on the current operator bidding for the new contract.
It's absurd in the extreme that our own public operator is the only rail company in the world that has been barred from challenging to run its own services.
Under a Labour government, a publicly owned company would be set up to bid for rail contracts. With an election on the horizon, Mr Duggar thought the East Coast decision had been rushed through on a rigged political timetable.
Given that we're only months away from an election and there's no political consensus for this major decision, will the Secretary of State give a formal written ministerial direction to his permanent secretary today outlining that he's still insisting on proceeding with this flawed process?
Patrick McLaughlin was sceptical, pointing out that Labour had not set up a publicly owned rail company when it was last in power. A fellow Conservative, Philip Hollobone, also had some doubts about Labour's response.
has just announced extra investment in our railways, extra services, extra trains, extra seats, and British-built trains for British passengers. And does he share my dismay at the economic illiteracy we've seen from the benches opposite? And the fact that this is a good deal for passengers, it's a good deal for all those who want to see our economy improve.
The Liberal Democrat Sir Alan Beath, the MP for Berwick-upon-Tweed, felt passengers would have more practical concerns.
What matters to my constituents is not who owns the operator, but whether the trains are on time, clean, reasonably priced, retain good staff and stop at places like Berwick and Alnmouth.
But Labour MPs remained troubled. Julie Elliott, whose seat is Sunderland Central, thought the government was unwise to give away the East Coast mainline profits.
Why does the government think it is better for our country to pass the profitable East Coast Main Line into private hands, money to shareholders rather than the people of this country?
The Transport Secretary questioned her logic.
Profits are not a bad thing. They go to pay pensions. They go to reward people who invest in companies.
Another Labour MP, Alison McGovern, thought passengers' bank balances would feel the pressure.
Virgin fares on the West Coast are excruciating. Will the Secretary of State say what exactly he can do to protect passengers on the East Coast?
Well, as I've said, that they are already in this franchise going to reduce some of the top fares by 10% from May of this year. And actually, if you buy tickets in advance, you can get some very good deals indeed.
The deal was great for passengers, Patrick McLaughlin insisted, and would make the route of the Flying Scotsman a world beater once again.
Rebecca Keating there. Now, there have been tributes in the Commons today to the Australian cricketer Phil Hughes, who died this morning, 2 days after being struck by a ball during a domestic match in Sydney. Phil Hughes, who was 25, was hit in the top of the neck and never regained consciousness. It was mentioned during Commons question time by the Labour MP, Sharon Hodgson.
Can I just offer my condolences on the very sad loss this morning of the cricketer Phil Hughes. I think the thoughts of the whole House will be with him and his family this morning.
The Culture Secretary, Sajid Javid, offered his condolences.
May I begin by saying how saddened I was to learn this morning that the young Australian cricketer Phil Hughes has died. I'm sure I speak on behalf of the whole of the House to say that our thoughts are with his teammates, his friends and his family.
The Shadow Minister for Sport, Clive Efford, expressed sympathy for the 22-year-old bowler in the match.
Can I associate myself with the comments of my honourable friend regarding Phil Hughes, and in particular for Sean Abbott, who's the bowler who's involved in that tragic accident. He must be feeling very terrible indeed.
Clive Efford there. Now, whenever the next coronation service is held, could it or should it contain non-Christian elements? A former Church of England bishop today suggested the service to crown the next monarch could easily feature readings from the Quran as a demonstration of modern-day Britain. Keith McDougall reports.
The radical suggestion came from Lord Harries, formerly Bishop of Oxford and now a crossbench or independent peer. The Lords was debating the role of religion in public life.
The relationship of the Church of England to the state has changed, is changing, and could change further in an inclusive direction that reflects our diverse society.
Lord Harries said the Church of England had built up good relationships with other faiths, and he talked about a service he went to in Bristol Cathedral last year. Both the High Sheriff and the city's Lord Mayor were Muslims.
And it was arranged that the Quran be read in the cathedral when everyone had been seated and welcomed, but before the actual Christian service began. It was, I think, a brilliant, creative act of accommodation that made the Muslim High Sheriff feel, as she said, warmly embraced, but did not alienate the core congregation, or indeed Muslims or Christians, by a blurring of boundaries. And I think this principle of hospitality can and should be reflected in many public ceremonies, including the next coronation service.
A similar message came from the Conservative Lord Cormac. He wanted to see a celebration of British values to mark the 800th anniversary next year of Magna Carta.
Because the adherents of virtually all faiths, be they Muslim, Sikh, Hindu, Jewish, virtually all can identify with those core values.
A Lib Dem, Lord Alderdice, avoided talking about any one religion, but he called on ministers to give more attention to what he called the complexity of other faiths.
We are finding an appearance of increasing fundamentalism, and that is becoming radicalised into dangerous action as well. So, my lords, I welcome this debate because I hope it also represents an increasing focus by our government in the need to understand the complexities of religion.
But a crossbench peer, Lord Hastings, believed blanket opposition to radicalism was sometimes misplaced.
If Church of England Christianity is to be known for its tolerance and its mediocrity, we have lost something profoundly essential. The very nature of faith allegiance, belief, and the love relationship that followers have of the one they follow requires radical living.
The former Labour Minister Lord Warner, who chairs the all-party parliamentary Humanist Group, sounded a stern warning about one set of private schools offering what's termed accelerated Christian education. Children at these schools were being given such a narrow education, he said, they were, in effect, being abused. Britain was a tolerant nation, he said.
That tolerance, my lords, rightly extends from adult to adult, but does not, in my book, extend to abusing vulnerable children trapped in households that deny them access to the balanced and broadly based education that the law entitles them to.
A moment of humour was provided by the Bishop of Norwich, the Right Reverend Graham James, who said a debate about the role of religion often came down to one about British values, values that
seem largely to consist of tolerance and queuing, though I've certainly been in queues which are not the least bit tolerant.
The bishop said too many people saw the state in today's Britain as inert, powerful and not on their side, and they viewed religion in much the same way.
Keith McDougall reporting. Paedophiles have been urged to come forward and admit their crimes to the overarching inquiry into child abuse. The plea was made by Labour's Simon Danchuk, who called on paedophiles to spare their victims the trauma of giving evidence about their abuse.
They will have tried desperately to bury the memories of abuse, but now they will have to drag them back into the light. They will have to relive that trauma. But you can spare them some of that suffering. You can come forward and admit your guilt, admit what you have done. Some of that pain can be saved and some people can begin to rebuild their lives.
The inquiry has been set up to look at abuse in institutions across the UK and to probe claims there was an establishment cover-up of crimes committed by politicians, judges and celebrities. Simon Danchuk admitted some of the claims, including that MPs had killed children, were shocking, but he was wholly convinced they should be taken seriously. He said police had admitted shutting down inquiries involving high-profile people.
These include Operation Circus, which focused on what was known as the Piccadilly Circus meat rack, where men would pick up adolescent boys for sex. Cyril Smith was among the powerful politicians spotted here taking boys back to a flat in North London. Questions must be asked as to why these investigations didn't continue.
A Conservative, Zach Goldsmith, had similar concerns about allegations of abuse at the Elm Guest House in his South West London constituency. He said vital evidence held by the owner had disappeared after the house was raided.
She had all kinds of photographs of establishment figures at her hotel, and one of them allegedly showed a former cabinet minister in a sauna with a naked boy. She had logbooks, names, times, dates, pictures of her customers and so on. All that evidence simply disappeared after the raids. It no longer exists, and that surely is astonishing.
Tim Lawton, a Conservative former children's minister, warned his colleagues it was not in Parliament's interest to cover up for any politician who was a paedophile.
A child sexual abuser who happens to have been a politician is no less of a vile criminal than a Jimmy Savile, than a rogue priest or any one of the others who form part of this overarching inquiry. And those who think that we would want to cover up other politicians who have been involved in this need to understand that cancer tarnishes all of us and that cancer needs to be cut out.
Now, at the start of the debate, MPs had been warned not to use their right to speak freely in the chamber to say anything which might jeopardise a police investigation. A Lib Dem, John Hemming, pointed out there were many rumours about who might be involved.
Some of the public have wondered, if we have parliamentary privilege, why are we not naming names? Speaking personally, I'm always concerned there's an evidence. There are lots of things said on the internet, but we need to remember that not everything on the internet is true. Furthermore, we also need to avoid prejudicing any formal inquiries.
The Child Abuse Inquiry is still without a chair after protests from victims forced the first two nominees to step aside. Speaking for Labour, Diana Johnson anticipates that with 100 candidates to process, there won't be a new chair until spring of next year. The Home Office Minister, Karen Bradley, said the appointment was a priority, but it would not be done without consultation with victims.
So that we can all be confident that we have the right person in place to lead this once-in-a-generation opportunity to deliver justice to those who have suffered and to save other vulnerable young children from the appalling abuse that so many have already endured. I think it is the least we can do.
Karen Bradley there. Now, the Defence Secretary, Michael Fallon, has offered his condolences to the victims of a Taliban suicide bomber who attacked a British embassy vehicle in the Afghan capital, Kabul. 5 people were killed, including 2 people who worked at the embassy. More than 30 people, many of them bystanders, were wounded. Mr. Fallon said Afghanistan remained a very dangerous place, but Britain's military intervention had made a positive difference. Robin Edwards reports.
On Sunday, the last British combat troops flew home from southern Afghanistan. Next week, London will host an international conference to rally support for the new government in Kabul. But the Defence Secretary's regular update to MPs was dominated by news of the latest casualties.
I begin by offering my condolences to those who were killed and injured in today's attack, sadly, including 2 British Embassy staff, which is a tragic reminder that there are some who still seek to undermine the progress that has been made towards peace and security in that country.
The sacrifices of the past 13 years had, Mr. Fallon said, given Afghanistan the best possible chance of a stable future. But there were no guarantees, as the attack in Kabul showed. The Shadow Defence Secretary, Vernon Coker, echoed his tribute to the armed forces and condemned the latest violence.
We're all shocked today by this morning's despicable terrorist attack on a British embassy vehicle in Kabul and those who have lost their lives. And it reminds us again of the dangers still faced and the challenges that remain.
Michael Fallon warned that there would be more such attacks because the insurgency had not been fully defeated. But he said Afghan forces were ready to take on that threat. 470 British troops would stay behind to support them, mainly as mentors at an army academy. The Conservative, Alastair Burt, was a Foreign Office Minister until last year.
As a former Minister for Afghanistan and who knows the embassy and staff there, can I add my own deep sadness to the events of this morning? This will have affected the place very badly and indeed the whole Foreign and Commonwealth Office family.
Labour's Stephen Doughty said he, like other MPs, had been protected and supported by British embassy staff on visits to Kabul. He expressed his sympathies to the relatives and friends of those who died.
I wondered if the Defence Secretary could set out plans for any national recognition or memorialisation of British civilians and civilian staff who served and lost lives and suffered injuries in Afghanistan during the campaign. And also on the issue of memorialising servicemen and women, has he issued any guidance to local authorities around the UK in addition to the national memorials as to how they could best and memorialise those who lost their lives in the campaign?
The Defence Secretary replied that some councils had decided to name streets after local heroes who'd lost their lives in Afghanistan, and that was something he would encourage. The main memorial in London would pay tribute to all those involved in the campaign, he added, including civilian staff. Labour's Paul Flynn wanted to know when there would be a public inquiry into Britain's military intervention. He quoted Hazel Hunt, the mother of the 200th soldier to die in Afghanistan, who now runs a charity for veterans.
My son was killed because of the politicians. They asked too much of the armed services. Mrs. Hunt is asking for immediate inquiry into the war. Can she have an assurance that that inquiry will not be delayed for 5 years as the Chilcot inquiry has been delayed, so that the guilty cannot hide the truth.
There's still no date for the publication of Sir John Chilcot's report on the Iraq War, although the hearings finished 3 years ago. Mr. Fallon insisted he was keen to learn the lessons of the Afghan campaign, but he said the government had not yet made a decision on the nature of any inquiry.
Robin Edwards reporting. This year is, of course, 2014 AD, but how many school children would be able to say what the AD stood for and recognise the words as Latin? When at Lord's Question Time a peer asked about the teaching of classics, the reply from the Education Minister, Lord Nash, included a sprinkling of the language.
We believe that classics can form a key part of a well-rounded education, or to put it in words that I'm sure my noble friend will understand, fundamentum disciplinae universi.
A question from a former arts minister, Labour's Lord Howarth, suggested his school days studying Latin and Greek had not been happy ones.
I declare an interest as having spent a disproportionate amount of my childhood studying Latin and Greek. Isn't it obvious that learning to decline the pluperfect subjunctive and to tell the difference between a gerund and a gerundive is a good preparation for modern life? And that study of the classics may indeed enable citizens to know what is the plural of referendum, whether it's referendums or referenda or neither.
Itawere.
Some peers looked as if that was all Greek to them. A Conservative, Lord McCall, said he was taught Latin and Greek in a grammar school in Scotland and...
It's now been discovered by studying the choruses in Aristophanes that the pronunciation that we were taught in Glasgow was much more akin to what the ancient Greeks spoke rather than England.
Pure Latin and Greek were devolved very early on, apparently. Now, the Home Secretary, Theresa May, featured on BBC Radio 4's Desert Island Discs last Sunday. Her favourite piece of music is Mozart's Queen of the Night from the Magic Flute, but she's also partial to a bit of ABBA, her favourite song being Dancing Queen. Politicians choose their music carefully when appearing on Desert Island Discs, but Labour's Anjali Eagle joked that she could think of a more appropriate ABBA track. She reckoned the Prime Minister was in political difficulties with some of his own party, so...
No wonder the Home Secretary has let it be known that she no longer rates the Prime Minister and has just given up on him. So, appearing on Desert Island Discs this week, she revealed that her favourite song is ABBA's Dancing Queen, when what she really meant was Take a Chance on Me.
Anjali Eagle imagined what it would be like to be stuck on a desert island.
Isolated from your friends, no one to talk to, no hope of rescue. It must be a bit like being a Liberal Democrat.
Well, I think our lady is a bit audacious in going into Desert Islanders when the party opposite can't even sing Stand By Your Man very well.
And William Hague joked that when she talked about somebody cut off from all his friends, he thought she meant the Labour leader, Ed Miliband. Finally, our main news again tonight. The Scottish Secretary has said the Smith Commission's plans to hand more power to Holyrood could lead to home rule for the rest of the UK too. And the government said selling off the East Coast Rail franchise will bring more passengers, services and better returns for investors. I'm Susan Hume. The editor was Christina Cooper. And that was Today in Parliament.
There are many more Radio 4 news and current affairs programmes to download for free. Find these on the website at bbc.co.uk/radio4.